where the phase of this current is lagged in synchronization with the waves we wish to receive, and then lagging it to 90 degrees and to Xia.
The smaller antenna has a much higher Q. The stored energy at any one instant of time in the smaller antenna is greater, but you cannot get a continuous energy flow that's greater. The effective capture area, the amount of energy in joules per second, watts, that it's going to absorb, is almost the same, within 95%. So it's absorbing energy at the same rate. The stored energy on each cycle in the smaller antenna, it's a much higher Q structure, the stored energy on each cycle is greater. You can transmit through that smaller antenna, but there's a catch. You probably can easily put a kilowatt of energy into the full-size dipole. You try putting a kilowatt into that small antenna, because it's running at a much higher Q, because the voltages on the tips are probably going to be 100 times greater. You're probably going to arc it over into air. You could do it in a vacuum, but you do it in air, you're going to arc over that antenna. You're limited in how much you can transmit. Up until that limit, the gain on transmission and the gain on reception will be the same. It'll obey the laws of reciprocity.
Can I challenge you with that?
Now, let me hear Glenn first. KC2QIQ, go ahead, Glenn.
It's kind of funny, I'm listening to this, and I think that there's something else here going on, too, with a bigger antenna. It's five an antenna at a quarter wave, and then, like, let's say if the antenna is a vertical, and I have a quarter wave, and I go to half wave, and from half wave to 5/8, and then I go to a 7/8 radiator, won't my radiation angle even go lower? So in other words, I'll technically have more gain, I think, overall as the antenna gets taller. I think I've actually seen and measured that on a vertical antenna, especially like in a mobile operation deck. Back to you, K2RW, KC2QIQ.
Once you've got enough dynamic range to your particular antenna tuner, if you and I design a really good antenna tuner, I can take an 80-meter antenna, I can make it work very well if it's 5 feet long, 15 feet long, 50 feet long, 150 feet long, 500 feet long, 5,000 feet long. If I've got a real good high dynamic range antenna tuner, I can give you a perfect 50-ohm match on the transmission line on any one of those antennas. There's a catch. If you now do a good computer plot, go to the right section of the antenna engineering, if you go to the right section of the ARRL antenna manual, you will see that as you make the wire longer and longer, it's developing more and more lobes in space. That's the laws of physics. The longer antenna has more lobes. Those lobes fall in very characteristic places, and you can't change where those lobes are going to be. You choose the length of the resonating or the radiator section of the antenna, and I'll tell you exactly where the lobes are going to be. Now you start off with that quarter wave ground plane. Let me drop. If the quarter wave ground plane really has a real good counterpoise, you've laid out a whole lot of wires for half a mile in all directions, and now you've got this quarter wave antenna, and in theory it's putting the maximum signal on the horizon and no signal straight up, and it's a fraction of that classic dipole pattern. It's a half wave dipole pattern where the Earth is right through the middle of it, if you know what I mean. You start making the dipole, the monopole, that started off a quarter wave, you make it a little bit longer. And it's starting to develop another lobe broadside. And that lobe broadside gives you the maximum signal on the horizon when the quarter wave ideal ground plane, quarter wave radiator is 5/8 wave. The magic of 5/8 wave is it puts the maximum signal on the horizon. You go beyond 5/8 wave, that lobe that you're getting toward the horizon moves above the horizon. It's not in the right place anymore. The antenna is in the process of developing more lobes, and as you slowly make the radiator longer, those lobes, more lobes come out of imaginary space into real space, and all of them shift in a very characteristic manner. The magic of 5/8 wave is the biggest lobe is on the horizon if you've got an ideal ground plane. Beyond 5/8 wave, that lobe is starting to move somewhere else. And you'll develop another lobe there as you go to much longer wavelengths, but now it's got a whole lot of other lobes in crazy places, and so that one lobe you care about on the horizon is no longer bigger. The biggest lobe on the horizon is 5/8 wave. That's why we so often heard about 5/8 wave. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Yeah, absolutely, Vic. I've measured similar things to that, and you know, just even in practice, you know, using mobile whips on the car, I can actually, you know, I've actually, you know, seen that. In other words, I've operated with a quarter wave antenna, half a wave antenna, has been using 5/8 on the mobile, and it's a very, very strong performer. And that's what I was wondering. I think I've seen some manufacturers list that as gain, but you know, I'm kind of afraid to put an actual gain number on that, but I think it might actually approach something close to 7 dBi, but I'll throw that back to you for comment. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Oh, you're going to get manufacturers to claim all kinds of gain numbers, because on the majority of antenna companies, the gain number is set in the advertising department, not in the measurement laboratory. Because they know full well that the average guy who's just starting out in ham radio and buying a whole lot of equipment, he looks at brand A and brand B and brand C. He looks at how many dB of gain he gets out of each one of those brands and how many dollars he's got to spend. And he's trying to maximize gain per dollar. And so they'll claim all kinds of things. The strongest signal on the horizon will be at 5/8 wave for an ideal ground plane. You're now putting that antenna on a not-so-ideal ground plane called automobile. It's an insulating object above the Earth with a certain amount of capacitance between it and the Earth. It doesn't necessarily have the same battery. And I'm not sure what the final number would be, and maybe it's going to be a little bit longer or a little bit less than 5/8 that's going to give you the strongest signal on the horizon. But it's in that neighborhood. A real dipole. It's got 2.14 dB of gain over isotropic. A quarter-wave ground plane is half of a dipole. Yes, an awful lot of the energy for the bottom hemisphere is no longer there. Does that mean all of the energy in the upper hemisphere just got 3 dB louder? Maybe it did. And so broadside from a quarter-wave ground plane, should it really be 3 dB plus 2.14, 5.14? Maybe. And can you get two more decibels out of that 7 dB over ISO because of 5/8 wave? I'm not so sure. We'll have to do a little more study on that one. But 5/8 is the maximum. 5/8 for the physical length of the radiator. When you make it electronically 5/8 wave, but it's physically shorter, you don't get that. It takes real estate to make an antenna pattern. Use
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
You start cheating on the physical real estate of the antenna, and the pattern will become broader, no matter what you've done electronically. The antenna pattern in space is a function of your amplitude distribution and your phase distribution across your radiator. You start making the radiator shorter physically, you're using up less space. You've got less, moment arm is the word the antenna people use. Antenna pattern is primarily a function of real estate. And within reason, you can fiddle around with it a little bit. If I've got a certain amount of real estate, and if I'm smart enough to put all the energy at the edges of the real estate and very little energy in the center, I can become a little bit more narrow in the main lobe. That's the good news. The bad news is the side lobes will get stronger. And by the way, you'd be amazed how many people think that when they talk about a parabolic dish antenna or a horn antenna and it has 60% aperture efficiency, they think the inefficiency, if it's 60% aperture efficiency, they say, oh, it's got 40% inefficiency, and they think 40% of the energy is in the side lobes. Good guess. Absolutely not. But that's another whole deep subject maybe we're going to go into tonight. But you asked this question, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, very good, Dick. As I said, you know, it's just interesting. Sometimes, you know, the I know it for certainly for automobile verticals that, you know, I've always been a fan of the 5/8 and the 7/8 wave. And I think like you've explained very well is that just because the ground plane of the car is not perfect, that sometimes even 7/8 might even give even a little bit better performance. But certainly I've, you know, measured all these things and actually seen it. And it does work. But let me pass it back to you, Dick. K2RW, KC2QIQ.
Was there someone else that also wanted to make a question or a comment on all of the above?
I want to challenge you on the small antenna versus big antenna.
Okay, we're about to go back to that. Let me see if there's anyone else on what we said so far. Okay, on the small antenna, are you saying the gain is not there, the effective capture area is not there, or I can't transmit the same signal strength through it up to the point of arc over? Are you telling me that the smaller antenna does or does not obey reciprocity, does not obey the calculation for effective capture area, does not obey the gain numbers that I was talking about? Which one of those are you challenging? Over to you, Wes, K2RAW.
It does obey. I agree with you. It is a very special application of the antenna that actually makes a very small antenna receiving much more energy than it normally would. So let's say we don't want to relay on this wiggling electrons in the wires of large halfway antenna to generate electromagnetic fields. What if we use a power supply instead? If an antenna is one of the 10,000 wavelengths across, we should be able to force it to behave as if it was huge, perhaps one-third wavelength across. We simply have to drive it hard with the RF source. We must drive it at the same time, at the same frequency as the incoming waves. Then adjust the phase and amplitude of the power supply to the special value. At one particular value, our transmission will cause that antenna to be the best absorbing to incoming waves. So, let me jump. So we have our little loop antenna to receive and want her to receive a radio energy much more than it normally be possible for that antenna. Then we need to produce a large AC current in the antenna coil where the phase of this current is locked in synchronization with the waves that we're willing to receive. We want to receive them. We want to lock them by 90 degrees. The voltage across the antenna terminal will stay about the same. And then we can compare it to the undriven antenna receiver, what undriven antenna receives if undriven antenna receives these waves. However, since the current is much higher in the driven antenna, the energy received per second is much higher as well. I know that it seems to like engineering blasphemy or for you, but how can adding a larger current increase the receiving power? And I believe that I'm able to answer that. Let me jump. And at the same time, this antenna won't start to transmit. And it does work. Power request volts per time times amps, the increased RF power received from the distant sources will increase the antenna amperage intentionally. And I know it sounds silly, but we can improve the reception of an electrically small antenna by using it to transmit. The secret will involve the cancellation of the magnetic or electric fields in the near field region of the antenna. And the physics of the near field region of the antenna has a kind of non-linearity because of the conductors are present. So, in the electromagnetic near field region, it is possible to change the E of the wave without changing the M. Change of the antenna voltage without the changing the current, and vice versa. That will send about superposition of electromagnetic traveling waves. So far in line.
Back to you.
Yeah, be careful you don't fall into a trap. There's a zillion website articles about these antennas that separately develop the E-field and the H-field, and they think there's some great physics advantage to it. And I'm convinced that it's not.
I'm going to just finish that, then I would ask you for the comment.
Now, I want to jump over to, you're not going to get any, out of an infinitesimal dipole, out of a very small dipole, you are not going to get more energy on reception than you did from a full half-wave dipole. And when you transmit into that small dipole, you're not going to get more transmitted energy than you would from a half-wave dipole. When you make that full-size dipole go down to one-tenth the size, in my example, and you lost half a dB, you're going to lose half a dB on reception. At the broadside, you're going to lose half a dB on transmission. No matter what you do, you're not going to get that back to a bigger number.
Okay. I agree with you.
Okay, go ahead, Wes.
I agree with you that the superposition of electromagnetic traveling wave does not quite apply. Yeah, because the Wong equation for the energy propagation near the conductors depends on dV square or I square separately. And the voltage is almost independent of current in the near field region. So if the very small loop antenna, let's say coil, should happen to receive a radio wave as a very small signal, we can increase the received energy by artificially increasing the current. Or if we're using a tiny dipole antenna, say a capacitor, okay, we can increase the short dipole received energy by applying a large AC voltage across the antenna terminals. What do you think about that?
You're not going to get something for nothing. If your point of reference is the full half-wave dipole on transmit and receive, and now you physically make it smaller on the exact same frequency, and you re-impedance match it, you're going to get a slightly broader broadside pattern. The peak of the broadside pattern will look like it's half a dB lower, which is not real loss. You just smear more energy somewhere else in space. So on reception, it'll be a little bit less than half a dB down. Instead of 2.14 dB, you'll have a little bit more than 1.64 dB on reception. If you used to get, and by the way, that half a dB of loss, just like John said earlier, turns out to be a voltage ratio of 94.4%. If you used to get 10 microvolts on reception with a full half-wave dipole, you're going to get 9.44 microvolts of reception with the small dipole. And when you transmit back to the guy, as long as you didn't arc it over, when you switch from the full-size dipole to the half-wave dipole, and he's a broadside station, he's going to see half a dB less signal.
Yeah, but what about the effective aperture? I believe that I have a comment on that.
Gain is aperture. You tell me the gain of the antenna. I plug it into a formula. Gain equals 4 pi A over lambda squared. I can solve it for A. A is gain lambda squared over 4 pi. Gain is a constant times area. You tell me the gain of the area. I tell you the exact area is... the area it's got. It can't violate that law. Gain is area, if you account for the constant. Over to you, Wes.
Okay, suppose if we add a strong electromagnetic field, the sum with the incoming electromagnetic plane waves and cause this radio wave to bend towards the teeny antenna, and the antenna absorbs them, okay, then this increases of the antenna effective aperture. Yes, it will. Oh, I think it will. We can use this process to alter the coupling between the antenna and surrounding space. But the total energy still flows to the conservation law. The altered fields only change the virtual size of the effective area of the antenna. Do you agree with that?
I think I do, and I'm going to reword it. Without a doubt, the smaller antenna, for the same signal strength on the antenna, the smaller antenna has a much stronger E field and a much stronger H field in the near vicinity of the antenna. Doesn't matter if it's receiving or transmitting. It's got a much stronger, very close by E field and H field. The voltage on the tips of the small antenna are much bigger. That little small antenna, 13 feet long, is still gathering energy over that great big oval of space, that 8,500 square feet. That oval is probably 150 feet wide and probably 60 feet high. It's an oval. And how can this 13-foot-long antenna gather energy over 150 foot of horizontal space? And it's that strong local E field that's doing it. That extra coupling that you're talking about, yes, it's taking place, and that allows you to have close to the same effective capture area as the full half-wave dipole. You've already used that when you resonated it for the smaller size. You can't go beyond that. You're not going to get more gain out of the small antenna than the full-size half-wave dipole, and you're not going to get more than dipole gain just because you've increased the local currents. If you haven't dedicated the real estate, you're not going to get the extra effective capture area beyond what you've gotten for the half-wave dipole. N2XJN, K2RIW.
Yeah, very good answer. I believe I've got a picture right now, and based on your words, I understand that we cannot increase the virtual size much beyond the quarter wavelength for the waves involved. And if we already have a large quarter wave, half wave dipole, then no matter how large is our artificial add-on AC voltage, we cannot make it absorb more incoming waves. And we have extremely small, let's say we have extremely small antenna. Let's say the antenna that works on 10 kilohertz loop antenna. The size of the pie plate, let's say, so we can make that antenna seem very, very large. We can do that. And we can think like this. How large is the diameter of an antenna near field region of the 10 kilohertz? And that would be about 10 kilohertz, 10 kilometers, if I'm right. So what if we could extract half of the incoming energy from that entire volume? In the theory, we can half can be absorbed and the other half can be scattered, and then teeny loop antenna sitting in our lab bench can intercept just as much energy as long wire halfway antenna with 10 kilometers long. Sounds bizarre for me. And to exist.
Yeah, I think the loop stick antenna, or a coil of wire is an antenna, listening to something like 10 kilohertz. If you build it in a manner that's completely lossless, and you conventionally impedance match it, I think it can suck up close to the amount of energy of a half-wave dipole on that frequency. I'm not sure about that, but I think it's possible. But you can get a greater amount of voltage out of it if you use it as a voltage probe antenna. In other words, by resonating the loop stick and not impedance matching it, but putting it into a field effect transistor, if you can make your loop stick circuit low enough in loss, it'll become very narrow band and very high in Q. But if you make it low enough in loss and you put it into a field effect transistor, which is an open circuit, I think you can get more voltage out of that than you would out of a half-wave dipole. It's not going to give you any real power gain. You're not going to improve the signal-to-noise ratio. It's an interesting experiment, but it doesn't give you anything that's practical because at these super low frequencies, the main thing that determines whether or not you're going to get communication is signal-to-noise ratio. Mother Nature's atmosphere, where there's probably 1,000 lightning bolts taking place during every single second somewhere on the Earth. There's all kinds of mechanisms of noise at low frequencies. A 1 megacycle antenna looks at the environment and it sees something like a 40 decibel noise figure. That's the amount of noise the environment's giving you. And as such, a very tiny antenna with very low efficiency on your little transistor radio can give you pretty good reception because it doesn't have to have a whole lot of gain. No matter what you do with a very tiny antenna, it's going to be a close to an omnidirectional device. Looking up signal at all directions at once. You got a little bit of a null off one end of the rod. But signal to noise ratio is what counts. So the guys on 20 meters, when the band opens versus the band being closed, Mother Nature's ionosphere giving you that signal or not giving you the signal could be an 80 decibel difference in signal strength. The ionosphere allowing you to hear the signal from England, and whether or not there's a whole lot of noise because some kind of a solar event going on, are the main determining factors as I see it, and whether or not there's a local thunderstorm is the main determining factors as to whether or not you do or don't hear the guy. Mother Nature dominates over your hardware. Into XJN, K2LIW.
Into XJN. Very interesting subject. I'm going to be even more radical. If we create a field which cancels out some of the energy in the extended region surrounding the teeny tiny antenna, that will violate the law of conservation energy. A field of energy cannot just vanish. Yeah, correct. If we cancel out the energy in the near field of an antenna, this is actually an absorption process, and that energy winds up inside the antenna circuitry. So by emitting electromagnetic field and a receiving antenna sucks electromagnetic energy into itself. Okay. Then if we actively drive an antenna with an anti-wave, don't laugh at me, we will force the antenna to produce stronger fields, which will cancel the incoming waves, and simultaneously this antenna absorbs more energy from the electromagnetic fields in the surrounding region of space than it would regularly or ordinarily would. So it also emits some waves of its own, but in the antenna theory, these waves are identical to the received signals, and they consider to be reflected, or let's say scattered, from the antenna. So, let me drop. I'm trying to don't lose myself in this thinking. We have a general law that we cannot receive electromagnetic waves without scattering half of the energy away again. I believe that I have an interesting part. If we wish to receive a power rather than signal as a critical, that would be a certain critical issue that arises. Driving a teeny antenna with a large signal will create a large current and heat the antenna. But a small antennas are inefficient when compared to the half-wave dipoles. We already established that. If we wish to maximize the virtual aperture of the real TV antenna, let's say this 10 kilohertz pi plate coil, and we know that the real one should have a 10 kilometers across, we'll quickly be frustrated by the wire heating, and all extra received energy will go into the warming copper. Trying to make a sense of what I'm talking, I believe that I have a solution. If we use superconductor loops at the low frequencies and use mirrors equivalent to the AC-driven superconductor, than the rotating permanent magnet or, let's say, rotating capacitor plates. Back to you.
A half-wave dipole on 10 kilohertz is something like 50,000 feet long, something like 10 miles long. That's not too practical. If you're trying to cancel the signal in a particular direction, you can do that. The reflector on a Yagi antenna does that. It cancels the antenna in one direction and increases the signal in the other direction considerably. So it displaced from the original emitting dipole, and you're using a kind of superposition. You can cancel in one direction, but it's going to increase somewhere else. If you wanted to cancel in all directions at once, you can only do that from inside the antenna, which really means you're canceling the signal before it got under the antenna in the first place. See, you don't come out ahead with that one. These very low-frequency antennas, at first you'd think you'd have to make an extremely big dipole to receive them, to create the H field with a coil of wire or with a loop stick is a very efficient way of doing it. And there are people who make the mistake of thinking, well, I only have to launch the H field, and that's all that radiates. Well, after you're away from the antenna a couple of wavelengths, Mother Nature straightens that all out. She starts that off with that H field that you generated, and any rate of change of magnetic field must, by the Maxwell's equations, create a rate of change of E field, and vice versa. Mother Nature very soon is going to straighten that all out, and it's going to become a real transverse electromagnetic wave in free space. There are people who think that they're going to launch a purely magnetic wave. Let me drop. For instance, the RFID tags that run at 13.56 megacycles. 13.56 megacycles is a real big wavelength. You know, it's more than 20 meters. Nobody uses a real antenna there. It's just a coil of wire that makes a magnetic field that couples into the RFID tag. And because of the way they couple into it, which is not extremely efficient, you only get a range to read that tag for a couple of feet and not much more. And there are people who think that 13.56 megacycle tag out of that particular reader is only there for a couple of feet, and then the signal dies. You use the right kind of receiver, you can easily receive that signal from 20 miles away, and the tag cannot, because the tag has to absorb enough energy to rectify it, to charge a capacitor, to run the integrated circuit chip that talks back to you. You could get a hell of a lot more range out of that if it had a battery, if the tag had a battery. But if the tag had a battery, it's not a cheap tag anymore. And you got to worry about replacing the battery. So even though you're only launching a local H field with that reader, it doesn't mean it isn't really launching a electromagnetic field. There's a lot of people who think you can design an antenna that only sends out a signal for 5 feet and then the signal dies. Mother Nature doesn't work that way. If you're really sending out a signal, it's going to go to every cubic meter of this universe. N2XJN, K2LIW.
Yeah, thank you for all of that explanation. It's a very fascinating subject. And if you recall, I started with the length of the light waves, 5,000 angstroms, and the teeny atom that is less than one angstrom in diameter. And then I asked the question, how we can explain how the teeny atom can receive a long light waves? How can we increase the voltage signal on the single atom? Andrew Exia.
Let me show you a real paradox. I start off with a piece of 10-gauge wire, and I pass steady-state DC current through it of 10 amperes. And I know that 10 to the 19 or 10 to the 18 electrons per second is 1 ampere, so it's going to be 10 to the 19 electrons. 10 to the 19 electrons per second are passing one particular spot. But on average, how fast are those electrons moving? And the answer is something like a tenth of a millimeter per second. The rate of change on average of those electrons at 10 amperes in a 10-gauge piece of wire is much smaller than 1 millimeter per second. Okay, now let me put 7,500 watts into a half-wave dipole on 80 meters, and I've made the dipole out of 10-gauge wire. Let me drop. The reason I chose 7,500 watts is because on a 70-ohm dipole, that equals 10 amperes. So I got 10 amperes of current flowing on the dipole. If it was steady-state current, the current would move less than a millimeter per second. But that wave is reversing 3,500 million times per second. I'm at 80 meters, 2.5 megacycles. So the signal is only there for, let me think, 1 megacycle is a nanosecond, 10 megacycles is 100 pico. Something like 50 picoseconds. The signal is going in the positive direction for something like 50 picoseconds, and then the other direction for 50 picoseconds. How far did the electrons move at 7,500 watts through a 10-gauge piece of wire? How far did they move? And the answer is less than the diameter of a copper atom. That's at 80 meters, at 7,500 watts. How far do they move if I'm running not at 80 meters, but I'm running at 10 gigahertz? We're talking about a hundredth or a thousandth of the diameter of the copper electron, copper molecule, copper atom. How in the world can such an extremely small motion of those electrons be creating that signal? Doesn't that sound like a paradox? We're moving very small fractions of the diameter of an atom, and that is a signal, and that's a whopping big signal at 7,500 watts. What happens if I'm running that signal at a picowatt, at the limit of sensitivity of my receiver? How far are those electrons moving?
The same distance.
No, oh no. The amount of distance is a function of the current.
Just a moment. Yes, you're right.
So for a very, very small current, at a very, very high frequency, the amount of motion on average is an extremely small fraction of the diameter of the atoms that contain the electrons. So we no longer can talk about what each individual electron is doing. In that copper wire, those outer valence electrons, the one single electron in the outer molecule, the outer ring of that copper atom, they're jumping all over the place. They're completely free to move. And we are biasing them a little bit with our signal. And we add that all up. The motion of any one of them, no matter what microscope you had, first of all, we don't have a microscope that can even see an atom. But now we're talking about signals that are a thousandth of the diameter of the atom is the amount of motion of the electron caused by the signal during that half cycle. It's obvious we're never going to view this one, Wes.
We're going to view the other one, but we can view an atom as a bond between the atoms.
By a scanning electron microscope, you...
That is correct.
Yeah, with a scanning electron microscope, you make indirectly a picture, but you didn't really see it directly. That's an indirect display from a tunneling microscope phenomenon. Over to you, Wes, K2LIW.
Yeah, I agree with what you said. I have a slightly different explanation for it. We don't need an angstrom-sized radio transmitter, and the key is the electromagnetic energy stored in oscillating fields, which is the resonance. If an atom resonates electromagnetically at the same frequency as the incident light wave, then from the typical classical standpoint, The other internal resonance nature will store electromagnetic energy that is accumulated from the incoming waves. And it will then behave as an oscillator. And then it will become surrounded by the increasingly strong AC electromagnetic field. So, as the time goes, and that's by quantum mechanics, the atom is surrounded by virtual protons at the resonant frequency. Let me drop. So if the alternating field is locked into the correct phase with the incoming light wave, then the atom's field can interact with the light wave's field and cancel out quite a bit of the light energy present in the near field region of an atom. So the energy doesn't vanish, and instead it ends up inside the atom. That's how we increase the voltage in a single atom. So half of the energy goes into the kicking of an electron and to the higher level, and the other half is re-emitted, or let's say scattered wave. Back to you.
When it comes to exciting a atom or molecule and kicking the electron to a higher orbit, a very careful process is required to do that. You've got to put in just the right wavelength at just the right energy level in order to do that. And it's an unstable condition most of the time. It's above the so-called ground state, and that atom is going to want to go back to the ground state. He's going to re-emit that exact wavelength, that exact amount of energy. When you and I shine a light on a crystal and you get a reflection off the surface of that crystal, those molecules on the surface are absorbing and re-radiating the signal that you put in. Just the surface molecules are absorbing and re-radiating. You're not really changing the status as I see it. You're not exciting those molecules to a higher energy level. Because if you were, you would see a very different change to the spectrum and the magnitude of the light as you change the intensity of the light that you're shining on that crystal. You half the intensity of the light on the crystal, and the reflected light goes down a half intensity. It obeys linearity all the way. You're not really changing anything at the molecular level, per se, is my belief. And each of these crystals that you and I care about are really a solid structure where all those molecules are locked in place, and the light that shines through that crystal does favor certain wavelengths. And I guess it's got something to do with the layout of the crystal and the spacing between the individual atoms. I'm not quite sure what's going on, but as you shine a light through a crystal, if for instance you try to shine a light through a piece of glass.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
And the light goes through the glass very nicely until you go to a lower frequency. Infrared, when you go to an infrared frequency, the piece of glass is opaque. And I don't have a good explanation for that one. How come when I go to a lower frequency, where I'm jiggling those electrons a little bit slower, and now the light doesn't go through anymore, it dies? I don't have a good explanation for that one, no, Wes. N2XJN, K2RIW.
If we're talking about the energy level in the atom, let me raise the theory. Let's say resonance. We're resonantly creating an anti-wave, which superimposes with incoming waves and bends them towards the atom. And that the teeny atom has sucked energy out of the enormously long light waves, 5,000 angstroms, as they go by. And since the atom has no conventional copper coils inside it wasting energy, it can build up some a really strong field, which allow it to behave extremely large when compared to its physical diameter. I know it sounds impossible, but if we go and try to track the Bohrhorn paper, if I'm not mistaken, that scientist is spelled B-O-H-R-E-N, B-O-H-R-E-N. H-R-E-N. Let me drop. He was analyzing the behavior of small metal particles and dielectric particles exposed to the long-wave electromagnetic radiation. And he was very rigorously showing the semi-classical analysis that the resonance of the resonator can cause dust motes to act larger than they really are. I know this is a theory, and I know that many people might not agree with it, but this is the official science. Back to you.
So you're saying his small particles of metal or small particles of dielectric material was giving reflectance like they were much larger than they really were? Is that what you're saying?
Correct. And yes, we may think how this stuff could be true. Well, the electric and magnetic fields cannot bend other fields. They cannot affect each other directly. They work by superposition. So for the same reason, a light wave cannot deflect another light wave. Well, but the mathematics of the fields around the coil or capacitor are not the same as mathematics of fairly propagating electromagnetic waves. So let's say we add the field of the bar magnet to the field of radio waves. And if the bar magnet is in the right place, at the spot where the phase of the B field of the radio wave is reversing polarity, then the radio wave becomes distorted in such a way that it is momentarily, it bends towards the bar magnet. And when the electromagnetic wave progresses, then we must flip the magnet over and over in order to keep the field pattern from bending away again during that following half a cycle. And the energy flow continues to funnel in towards the rotating magnet. Do you follow me so far?
In free space, a bar magnet is going to have no effect on an electromagnetic wave. But if the bar magnet is brought close to ferrite material, and I am propagating a radio wave through the ferrite material, now that bar magnet can allow me to change velocity of propagation as part of the theory of operation of a ferrite circulator. Also, I can make a ferrite switch out of external magnetic fields. There are switching devices that run at high power microwave frequencies where there's ferrite material in the waveguide. On the outside of the waveguide there's an electromagnet, and as you turn the current on the electromagnet, you can make the ferrite inside switch the signal from output waveguide number one to output waveguide number two, or to pass the signal and stop the signal. You can do some fancy things with an external magnetic field on an electromagnetic field propagating through the ferrite. I don't quite understand how that works, but I've seen the circuits that do it. N2XJN, K2RIW.
Well, one of the possible answers is, let's say I was talking about the rotating magnet. So let's replace the bar magnet with the AC coil and vary the coil current so the fields stay locked to the traveling radio wave in the same way. And in that case, the wave energy will always bend towards the coil and be absorbed. So the superposition still applies, but this is a coherent superposition. So it acts like a static field pattern, as if the permanent magnet can bend a radio wave inwards and absorb its energy rather than simply having the field zone together without the interesting results. I can note that the coil will emit its own electromagnetic ripple, and this emission will be known as the atom that is ideally, no, that the atom will ideally scatter half the light they absorb, and the dipole antennas behave similarly. That they scatter incoming electromagnetic waves, you've got to correct me in this one, as they absorb part of the energy. So when all I said about the oscillating coil, okay, has absorbed half of the incoming electromagnetic wave, and let's say the re-emitted or scattered the rest, then in the phase lag system we cannot tell the difference between the reflection and transmission. I'm getting lost in here.
I'm being led to believe that an awful lot of what goes on in a ferrite material in the presence of a strong, nearly steady state magnetic field is that you're affecting the precession rate, the rate of precession. When you put a single one-turn coil where one of them has a plane north-south and the other one has a plane, XY and the other one is XZ, you've got two one-turn coils at right angles to each other around a small sphere of ferrite material called yttrium iron garnet. And inside that sphere of yttrium iron garnet, precession is taking place, and the rate of precession is a function of the strength of the magnetic field. Ordinarily, those two coils are at right angles to each other and no signal couples between the two.
Do you talk about the same precision as happened in nuclear magnetic resonance?
It might be, and I'm not sure. I'm now describing what happens inside of a Yig filter, and I've used Yig filters for many years. And so when I hit the precession rate at, let me pick a number, 3 gigahertz, I've put the right amount of magnetic field so that the magnetic field inside of the Yig sphere is precessing at 3 gigahertz. Then when I put a 3 gigahertz signal into the first one-turn coil, at right angles, the second one-turn coil sees that signal with half a dB of insertion loss. The signal couples across these two right-angle coils when the precession rate is equal to the frequency of interest. And that gives you a beautiful filter. And it's an extremely linear filter. As you change the strength of the magnetic field, it gives you a straight line filter characteristic from 2 gigahertz to 18 gigahertz, and it's an extremely straight line on that graph. So the exact percentage of current that I put into the coil that's making the magnetic field gives me the exact frequency that the signal will go through that filter.
Dig, you are Mr. Beautiful, John. Did you hear that? That explains part of our problem that we were dealing with, but go ahead.
It's extremely linear between 2 gigs and 18 gigs. The catch is it will not go below 1.8 gigs. It stops working below 1.8 gigs. But from 2 gigs to 18 gigs, it's extremely linear. You double the magnetic field, you double the frequency of the precession rate, you double the frequency that flows through that filter.
How low we can go with the precession effect with the frequency?
Down to 1.8 gigs. Until you do something with fancy doping of the Yig material, it will not operate below 1.8 gigs.
Do you envision any way that we can get precession in lower frequency any other way or by any other method?
There must be, because they do make, I believe this precession phenomenon also explains why in a circulator, the signal that's going from port 1 to port 2 to port 3, I call that the clockwise signal, that propagates at one rate, and the signal that goes from 3 to 2 to 1 in the opposite direction, counterclockwise, propagates at another rate. And the Yig filter does its beautiful selecting job where the signal going into port 1 comes out of port 2. The signal going into port 2 comes out of port 3. The signal come out of going into port 3 comes out of port 1. But in the other direction, it doesn't do that.
Do you recall the experiment of nuclear magnetic resonance from New Zealand, the set of videos that you have seen working at 50 hertz using the magnetic field, natural magnetic field of the Earth, that would stand that the precession can happen also at very low frequency, right or wrong?
I'm convinced that precession can definitely happen at a lower frequency because I can buy a circulator that does a beautiful job at 800 megs, 300 megs. They're very large, but they make circulators at lower frequencies. They do not make Yig filters at those lower frequencies. So there's something different about Yig versus the material that are used in circulators. It's not quite the same material. They're both ferrites.
Can you formulate just quickly, what factors do we need for the precession to take place?
About the hydrogen precession, Wes, he's talking about Yig material, two different elements.
Talking about material, we're talking about precision as a factor. Okay, so what I need is to find out which factors, which conditions are very much characteristic to precession.
The frequency of RF energy that's transmitted as a brief pulse in an NMR, in an MRI machine, isn't that something like a couple of hundred megacycles?
Could be a couple of hundred megahertz cycles. It could be 13.25 megahertz that is very widely used, but it could be also 50 hertz, what I have on my table, which is the main element of nuclear magnetic resonance. We're talking about the precession. We're not snapping it to any other things. Back to you, Dick.
I'm guessing that a very small magnetic field on the right material will make it precess at a very slow rate. What I have seen, evidence, is that once you've got the right kind of material with the right kind of precession taking place, the rate of precession appears to be extremely linearly related to the strength of the magnetic field.
I agree with that. Anyhow, that precision factor is very much important to me because of the certain reasons. It could happen at very low frequencies, although it has to be a certain device, either the very large device or very specially made device in order to put, for the precession to take place. Back to you.
In the case of MRI, I think we're processing, is it the hydrogen molecules that are in the water?
Hydrogen molecules, that is definite.
So it's the hydrogen molecules that are part of the water that's in each of the organs. Is that what we're imaging to your knowledge, John?
Absolutely. Absolutely correct. That's exactly what they're imaging. But they're using a different type of imaging than you think. First of all, they're using the spin echo effect, which is a little more complicated. But basically what they're doing is they align the elements, the hydrogen elements, with a magnetic pulse which cancels the, overtakes the Earth's magnetic field for 5 seconds, 10 seconds, and then they induce with a coil a tilting effect which causes the proton to tilt, and when that tilt, they want it to tilt to the 90 degree position, and then its rotation creates a magnetic field which is induced to the, into the same coil, which is causing it to spin.
Do they ever image any other molecule besides a hydrogen molecule or hydrogen atom? Do they ever look to do this with any other atom, or is it only hydrogen to your knowledge? John, go ahead.
The military experiment, John.
In the MRI, they only use the hydrogen element because they don't use low temperature. temperatures, but there are other items that they can use and detect. But hydrogen seems to be the one they chase economically, I assume, because they can do it without chilling the body. The body can stay at a proper temperature.